move to the second case this morning, which is Levy v. Pappas.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Stephen Plotkin on behalf of the plaintiffs, Charles Levy, and Refund Research Associates. Your Honor, the complaint that was presented to the Federal District Court was one in which plaintiffs alleged that the defendants, who are high officials at the Cook County Treasurer's Office, the County Assessor's Office, and the State's Attorney, engaged in a campaign that was designed to intimidate and destroy the constitutional rights of the plaintiffs by destroying the business of Mr. Levy as retaliation for the filing of a whistleblower case in the state court. By any standard, by the CALUPA standard that this court has announced, given the factual allegations, the reasonable inferences in support of those allegations, it clearly meets the standard that it's possible that that there are a set of facts that would support the right to relief that the plaintiffs seek.
Now, Mr. Plotkin, you may be right that in the midst of this case is a retaliation claim that doesn't have anything to do with collection of taxes or computation of refunds or the like. But it seems to me a lot of the counts of this complaint do deal with tax matters. And would you agree that that at least has to be dismissed, part of the case, on the basis of the Tax Injunction Act?
Not at all, Your Honor. And it's true that what the district court did was eliminate virtually all the federal counts in the complaint pursuant to the Tax Injunction Act.
Well, I'm not drawing a federal-state line. I'm drawing a does it have to do with tax refunds versus is it about retaliation for filing, you know, for instituting a criminal investigation, for example?
No, the United States Supreme Court in 2002 decided the case of Hibbs versus Wynn. In that case, which was totally ignored in the decision by the federal district court, the proponent who was seeking the dismissal of the cases of that case pursuant to the Tax Injunction Act argued that under prior Supreme Court precedent, the Tax Injunction Act swept away any matters that dealt with the administration of the state tax system. And the United States Supreme Court rejected that argument.
Well, they do reject it. They say this is tax credits. It's not the flow of revenue, which would include refunds. But Hibbs doesn't overrule the case that the district court did look to, which was the fair assessment and real estate decision. Hibbs leaves that untouched.
Hibbs discusses the state tax administration and the refund component of it in the particular context that made clear that what fair assessment was looking at was something that was clearly prohibited under the Tax Injunction Act. That is a far cry from what's involved here. The plaintiffs who presented no challenge to any of the amounts that were paid, the assessments that were undertaken. They're not contesting the validity of the act, and they took no action that that resulted in their not having paid the taxes that were due. These plaintiffs are not involved in that aspect of the case, and Hibbs says you have to look for the right to relief. The right to relief that the plaintiffs are seeking is money damages resulting from the constitutional violations that they experienced at the hands of the defendants.
But, you know, there's another area of the law, the Rooker-Feldman area, that uses a phrase that I actually hate because no one can pronounce it, inextricably intertwined. But it seems to me that here a lot of your case is about your client's participation in this refund process. Of course, when their clients don't get the refunds, then they don't get their fee or share, whatever you want to call it, of the price or of the amount of the refund. And so it's very hard to evaluate, and I would say perhaps impossible to evaluate at least those monetary claims, without delving right into the tax refund process. And again, I want to separate out your claim for retaliatory criminal investigation. That does seem to me to be quite separate, but there's a lot that's really awfully close to the tax refund process.
Well, these plaintiffs are not seeking tax refunds. Tax
no,
refunds are
their...
being sought in the state court
right.
by the state class
action
plaintiffs.
But that's
why
I use the term inextricably intertwined. Their claim really is all about the tax refund process, whether this one form, you know, is enough to generate the right to a refund, or whether the other statute has to be used, et cetera.
It's in their position as the officials who are dealing with and discriminating against plaintiffs in the course of their business. That's the basis of the class of one equal protection claim, that Refund Research Associates was subject to discriminatory treatment compared to other similar companies similarly situated in the business at doing business over at the county treasurer's office. And the district court never ruled on that issue at all.
Before the district court, were you mentioning the names of these other companies that were your comparable companies? Because surely, if you can't get under class of one, there's definitely no protected class here. It's just an economic discrimination.
They're listed in the amended complaint, amended complaint, and they were never addressed at whatsoever. That was one of the specific things that we raised in the first amended complaint to get around some of the problems that the district court had identified in their original complaint. Furthermore, we identified specifically actions that were taken within the two-year period prior to the time that the suit was filed in connection with the class of one claim, as well as in connection with the 1983 claim involving the continuing criminal investigation into plaintiffs.
Some of those, or at least one, looked to be that your client used as a subcontractor was one of these companies, right?
She had been used as a subcontractor for Refund Research Associates and then later went into the business herself after at the tail end of the time in which Refund Research was still operating before it was dissolved.
Was the county issuing checks to clients of those, or to the companies rather than the clients during this time, and not in your case?
That's correct. For some period of time, the county had taken the names of the high profile or high volume companies like Refund Research off the checks that were then sent to the clients. Later on, that was rescinded as to other companies, but we allege it was never rescinded as to Refund Research, and it was one of the primary reasons why the district difference in treatment establishes that class of one claim. With respect to res judicata, the law is fairly clear that, and I shouldn't have said fairly, the law is clear that a dismissal for standing under lack of standing under state law is not a final adjudication on the merits. Second portion of our res judicata argument is that there's a different set of operative facts at issue here. There were different injuries that were sustained by these plaintiffs compared to the putative action that was filed seeking mandamus in the state court. Different legal theories, different causes of action, and it would be unfair and unjust to impose res judicata as to from the decision in the mandamus action to this case. With respect to standing, Plaintiff Levy clearly has standing to assert claims. Similarly, Plaintiff Refund Research Associates has standing under the class of one count as well as under the RICO counts. The district court.
I don't see, you know, with Refund Research Associates, where it does, where it is in fact the injured party. Where, what's its injury in fact here?
Its injury is that it was driven out of business, lost profits, lost the value of the business, and was sustained that economic injury. It flows to Mr. Levy, and therefore Mr. Levy would have standing, we'd assert, to assert the claims of Refund Research. He's the president, sole shareholder of the company. He's certainly not going to settle cheaply on this, and he's in a position to go ahead and present particularized proof of all those claims that Refund Research would have incurred. There was an issue also that led to the district court to dismiss the claim on the basis of lack of timeliness, the continuing criminal investigation claim. And with respect to that issue, we disagree that that was a proper basis.
Do you happen to know what the statute of limitations in Illinois is for crime?
I do not.
I mean, some crimes, obviously this isn't murder, so it's not, wouldn't be one where there's no statute. So I just wondered if it was still running for this particular alleged incident.
I do not know. I was assuming that even with the two-year statute, what we have here is, and what we had argued in the complaint, in the in our briefing, was there's a continuing violation. There's some cloud that's going on with respect to this criminal investigation. And
there's never been a statement that the file is closed.
There has not, and right. We specifically alleged in the complaint that he was never told that it was closed. Moreover, what happens is in May of 2001, hundreds of letters get sent out to former clients of Refund Research and Mr. Levy announcing that there's a criminal investigation. Mr. Levy writes a Freedom of Information Act request to the Treasurer's office because the letter had indicated it was based on a complaint, and he receives a response that says there is no such written complaint. So he follows up on that, and he says, what about unwritten complaints? Can I get some information on that? And they play cutesy with him and basically say, you're not entitled to that information. It's privilege, and they leave it like that. Things remain dormant. Mr. Levy isn't contacted by the state's attorney's office. In fact, as far as we're aware, nobody's directly contacted by the state's attorney's office until his subcontractors come under scrutiny in the middle of 2003 and into 2004, both of which are well within the period of time that made the complaint for the 1983 count on that basis timely. So the response from the state's attorney is effectively a lulling. You know, Mr. Levy said, look, if I got something to worry about, I want to know what it is. They don't provide him with any information. In fact, they say, look, there was no written complaint at all. And so we don't believe that that May 2001 dissemination of that letter precluded Mr. Levy from asserting that there was a continuing violation going on that only became apparent when persons were actually interviewed and where the possibility that he was going to be charged for forgery was one that asserted itself.
Mr. Poggin, you're cutting into your rebuttal time.
Thank you very much.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Paul Castiglione, and I represent the defendants, appellees, in this case. Your Honor, as Judge Wood, as you indicated in the earlier questioning, all of plaintiffs' claims for damages here and the federal claims are derivative to the refund claims of their alleged clients, and that is their clients.
Well, except for the retaliation claim. I want to talk about that separately.
That's right. There's really two sets of claims here. There's the damage claims based on the refunds that plaintiff says should have been issued in warrant, and it is a retaliation claim. The Tax Injunction Act and principles of comity bar the federal damage claims, Your Honor. And as to the First Amendment retaliation claims, the only allegations in the complaint, the First Amendment complaint, of retaliation were directed toward two defendants, Treasurer Maria Pappas and Peter Karahalios, who's the former chief deputy treasurer. Those allegations relate to conduct by Mr. Karahalios and Ms. Pappas that occurred in 2000 and 2001. There is no continuing violation here. There's allegations regarding actions that the state's attorney, individuals in the state's attorney's office, not defendants here,
You're talking now about the First Amendment issue.
That's right.
Where you're looking at the two-year statute.
That's right, Your Honor. There is no continuing violation regarding any conduct by Mr. Karahalios or Ms. Pappas. Their conduct occurred in 2000 or 2001. Mr. Levy was aware of it. This suit wasn't filed until 2004. So the only First Amendment retaliation claims that were properly made in the complaint are time-barred on the face of a complaint. Plaintiff pled himself out of court.
I want to go back to the Tax Injunction Act for just a minute, though, because certainly if you sat around and read law review articles about that statute, you would see lots of people tearing out their hair with what the Supreme Court has done. You know, one minute you find out, you know, that's about tax administration and the flow of revenues, and the next minute you say, well, but it's maybe not all tax administration. And the court has drawn some very fine lines between Hibbs and the Fair Assessment case and various other cases. So, you know, the real question is, why is this case, which is certainly not anybody trying to impede the flow of revenues into Cook County, the revenues are coming in, and people are saying once it's been adjudicated that the money is actually in effect ours, you know, we just want it to be paid, you know, pay the check. Why is that so close to tax administration that it belongs under the Fair Assessment decision, not Hibbs?
In fact, Your Honor, that didn't happen. There was not an adjudication that a refund was owed, and I think that's a key misunderstanding that plaintiff bases their complaint on. If I could explain, I have to delve a little bit into the Illinois Property Tax
Brief.
Code.
Yeah.
That's right, Your Honor. What plaintiffs did is ask the Cook County Assessor to file certificates of error to reduce the assessment of the value of various parcels of property belonging to their clients. Now, let me explain certificate of error is. What it really is an evidentiary objection that the assessor can file to the collector's application for judgment and order of sale of delinquent taxes. Section 14-15 of the Property Tax Code authorizes the assessor, and only the assessor, to file a certificate of error. There are no private rights. There is no private right of action under 14-15. And if you notice in plaintiff's complaint, basically they allege that their right to a refund is based on that. So here's what happened. Plaintiffs, Mr. Levy and Refund Research Associate, asked the assessor to file a certificate of error to lower the assessed value of various parcels of property. I could do that for my neighbor, Your Honor. That doesn't mean that unless the neighbor actually, in fact, applies for a refund with the collector, but he's entitled
to
it.
Under the 175 procedure.
That's right, under 2175. Oh, and it doesn't mean that I'm entitled to say the collector will give me the refund and I'll hand over.
If you were the agent, though.
Oh, absolutely, Judge. If I were the agent, I could. But let me talk about that. 2175 allows either the taxpayer, the person who overpaid the tax, or in this instance, 2175 deals with refunds in two situations, where there's been straight overpayment, the tax due was, say, $1,000 and someone paid $1,500, or maybe the tax was paid twice. But it also deals with refunds in situations where there was an erroneous assessment, which is what we're talking about here, where the assessment was placed at a certain value, but the taxpayer failed to ask for an exemption, a homeowner's homestead exemption or a senior exemption. And there's procedures whereby you can go in and ask the assessor. Assessor can file a certificate of error. If it's adjudicated in the taxpayer's favor, the assessed value of the property is lowered. But that doesn't perfect a refund, because, in fact, the assessor can do all that where taxes haven't been paid at all. And what the Property Tax Code contemplates is that there's a separate procedure under Section 2175 to ask for a refund. If the collector and the taxpayer, or the claimant, I guess, a better way to say it, can't agree, there's remedy in the state courts. There's an appeal process for the Circuit Courts of Illinois. So that, in fact, is the remedy that's available to obtain a refund. I don't know. What we know here is that that plaintiff's clients didn't do that.
What Mr. Plotkin argues, I understand it, is that he's not, or the focus of his client's case isn't down there in the nitty-gritty of the Cook County tax system. It's kind of a few steps removed where he's saying, you know, we were trying to play a part in that and you tried to push us out of business, in fact, successfully pushed them out of business. So what is all of that detail actually relevant to his complaint?
It isn't, Judge, because ultimately the main complaint he made is that refunds weren't issued, that money wasn't paid over. And that is, in fact, a restraint on collection because under Illinois law, when a tax is paid, voluntarily paid, it's the collector's duty under the cases we cited, the Wooddale cases, and also under the property tax code, sections 2140 and 2145, to immediately distribute that revenue to the taxing districts. So to come back and say a refund is due is a restraint on collection. It's basically halting a collection and saying, collector, take money from future refunds. And that's how it works in Illinois, that, in fact, when a refund is paid, the collector doesn't have some pile of money sitting there. What she does is she'll go to future collections and on a pro rata basis pay a refund out of future collections. So asking for a refund is a restraint on collection, Your Honor. To go back to your question, that's why the Tax Refund, the Tax Injunction Act and principles of comity are implicated here.
To go back to the claims you say are time barred, that is, I gather, the disparate treatment of Refund Research Associates compared to other collectors, where the allegation is, I gather, that at one time the checks were issued jointly and then quit being issued jointly, and other requirements or unavailability of procedures within the office. That's all time barred, you say?
Well, actually, Judge, that's part of the complaint about the refund system. The complaint, the retaliation is the plaintiff's allegation that a criminal investigation was initiated against him because he filed a whistleblower suit in state court, which I would inform Your Honors, by the way, has been dismissed and it's currently on appeal in the Illinois Appellate Court. So really, the First Amendment, the retaliation case deals with the initiation of a criminal investigation.
But why would that be time barred? You know, that's why I asked about the Illinois statute of limitations. A criminal investigation is not a moment in time, like hiring somebody or firing somebody or the like. Criminal investigations typically go on for some indefinite period of time, up to and including the end of the statute of limitations that binds the particular prosecuting authority. I don't see why, with that cloud over his head, that at least isn't still something that Mr. Levy can complain about.
A couple things, Your Honor. First of all, I think the statute of limitations under Illinois law for this sort of criminal prosecution, I think, is 3 years. But even beyond that, he was never
indicted. So he's in time. If that means he has to sue within 3 years of the end of that period of limitation, he's in time.
I don't think so, Your Honor. No, I disagree, Your Honor, because he was never indicted, and his complaint was not that I was indicted and I had to incur costs for hiring an attorney. It was just that an investigation was initiated at all. And he knew that at the very latest, 2001.
But are you saying that somebody can't have damage from a retaliatory criminal investigation where all of his clients and everybody are being contacted by the state's attorney's office? If it were, assume for the sake of argument, which I'm sure is not your position, but that it were an utterly vindictive, retaliatory criminal investigation, there's just no remedy?
Well, Your Honor, I think we have to look at when plaintiff knew when the cause of action accrued.
What I'm saying. Why wouldn't, at least in my hypothetical of the totally vindictive investigation, why wouldn't it continue throughout the period of potential investigation until it's simply not open to the state anymore to continue?
Well, I think the answer to that is you have to look at who's being sued. If, in fact, there was a suit against the people doing the investigating, which I think significantly there's not, the only defendant from the state's attorney's office here is Mr. Devine in his official capacity. And I'm not sure, he may be in his individual capacity, but it doesn't matter. The 11th Amendment bars the official capacity claim, and there's no allegation that Mr. Devine himself was making phone calls or doing any type of investigating. So they haven't really sued the right defendants to bring the type of claim in Your Honor's hypothetical. The only people that plaintiffs have brought retaliation or made allegations against are Mr. Karahalios and Ms. Pappas, and their actions ended in 2001. And so there's no continuing action by them that would lead to liability. And I don't think plaintiff can go back outside the statutory period, the two-year period, to bring them in. Your Honors, if I may briefly just address, as I see time is running a little short. As to the interpretation of Section 2175 and Section 1415 of the Property Tax Code, these same plaintiffs, represented by same counsel, filed a suit in state court, where the mandamus action, which was dismissed, and I think significantly what the trial court there found was that Section 1415 only granted authority to the assessor to file a certificate of error. It did not generate a right to a tax refund. That decision was not appealed, and I think it's res judicata. It may well be collateral estoppel as well. I don't think
Where's the identity of parties?
It's the exact same parties. It was Refund Research Associates.
Action.
Well, it was Refund Research Associates, and it was Mr. Levy. And it was the claim there was the request was a writ of mandamus ordering the collector to issue 1,650 refund checks because Mr. Levy and Refund Research Associates had asked that certificates of error be filed for those parcels of property. It's the exact same. The same legal issue that's been advanced here.
Mr. Plotkin argues it wasn't resolved on the merits because of the no private right of action or
What Judge Jagielski said was he dismissed it for all the reasons in open court, and one of which was that Section 1415 doesn't generate a right to a refund. In fact, what he said was that under 1415, all the assessor could do was file a certificate of error, and he's already done it. So there was no way he could issue a writ of mandamus to tell the assessor to do what he's already done. There was no remedy he could order against the collector. So I think in that sense, I think res judicata does apply, Your Honor. I don't think Refund Research Associates has standing to bring a First Amendment claim on behalf of Mr. Levy. There's no any allegations of retaliatory conduct against Ms. Pappas or Ms. Carajalios were directed to Mr. Levy. They weren't directed to Refund Research Associates. So I don't think they have standing to bring that claim. I'll finish with two points, Your Honor. There are no First Amendment claims brought against any of the other individual defendants here. There are claims brought, but there are no allegations made. We detail that in our brief. The allegations cited by Mr. Plotkin do not relate to any sort of First Amendment retaliation claim. And finally, Your Honors, the district court dismissed Cook County and James Crawley as defendants in here because summons and complaint were not served on these defendants within 120 days of filing. I believe that decision was not an abuse of discretion. In briefs throughout in the initial motion to dismiss, I placed a footnote in the brief saying that neither Mr. Crawley or the county had been served yet, and yet they weren't. And that was in 2005, and yet they weren't served until February 2006. So I think the district court did not abuse its discretion in dismissing those defendants on that basis as well. So for all those reasons, Your Honor, we'd ask that the district court's decision be affirmed, and if the court has no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. How much time? You have 1 minute, Mr. Plotkin.
With respect to the decision by Judge Jagielski, the transcript at page A79 of the supplemental transcript, the court says, your argument is, and I understand your argument, that they don't have standing for that for several reasons, and Mr. Castiglione's response is right. There was no finding that there was no standing. There was no any discussion about the proper interpretation of the state property tax code was superfluous.
That is, though, of course, a question of law. Why isn't it something this court at least could look at?
The claim that Mr. Levy first asserted in this case was also brought as assignee for various taxpayers who had filed applications for refunds. That was dismissed by the district court, and we never reviewed that or renewed that when it came to the first amended complaint, and we're not seeking any relief on that on appeal now. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel.